May it please the court, counsel. I feel obligated to first address the government's contention that this appeal was not timely filed. The government claims that this is a criminal appeal and that the 30-day time limitation for civil appeals should not apply, as the notice was filed more than the 10 days allowed for criminal appeals. Now, the order we are appealing from here is, we believe, clearly a civil matter. The government's position is apparently that the court should look only at whether the case is on the criminal docket and whether the order arises from a criminal case. That position is certainly contrary to what this court has said and other courts have said on several occasions. As this court said in the Taylor case, which was involving a gun, whether a gun privileges should be restored to a criminal defendant, that the line between civil and criminal matters is not always clear. In the Perry case from the Sixth Circuit, that court held in a case which we think is almost indistinguishable as to the nature of the order appealed from. It also involved a lien and the government's attempt to collect restitution. In that case, the 30-day time limitation for civil appeals was held to be the proper one.
I would think that if you didn't have a time problem here, you just looked at this case and decided, is a action that grows out of enforcement of the Mandatory Victims Restitution Act, that would be characterized, I would think, as criminal ordinarily.
Well, this court has said the restitution is not a criminal sanction. It's an equitable sanction, and that it really arises more from the concept of unjust enrichment than part of any sentence.
But it grows out of a criminal case. It's the judgment of a judge imposing a criminal penalty. Time limits aside, I mean, just looking at that issue, I would think I'd be more inclined to say it's a criminal proceeding.
One of the reasons the government gives for why the criminal rule should apply or the criminal time limit should apply is that, well, in criminal cases, you know, there's a need to determine the sentence, whether a defendant's going to have to serve the sentence and so forth. This was 13 years ago that Mr. Lee was sentenced in this case. A restitution order is indistinguishable, at least where we're at now, from a judgment. It can be enforced as a civil judgment, and that is really all that is at issue here, is how this judgment is to be, the judgment of restitution, how that is to be enforced. Now, yes, it had its origin 13 years ago in a criminal judgment and an order of restitution that was imposed as part of a criminal case. That's undeniable. But whatever criminal aspect this had is pretty much long gone. It is simply a judgment to be enforced like any other judgment. And that's why we think it would be unfair, really, to say, yes, the time limitations, the 10-day time limitation for appeals applies. In fact, the government has, in the Palma case, which we cited in our reply brief, itself argued that the government's case, the 60-day limitation applies here. So we believe that the proper time limitation is the 30 days for civil appeals. Now, turning to the merits of this appeal, the issue is pretty straightforward in our view. It's whether restitution that was ordered by the court is limited to 25% of the, excuse me, whether the restitution, the 25% limitation that applies for under the Consumer Credit Protection Act applies to periodic pension payments. The Section 303 of this Consumer Credit Protection Act, which is the limitation of 25%, applies to earnings and disposable earnings. And then the Consumer Credit Protection Act also defines earnings, and it defines earnings to include periodic payments pursuant to a pension or retirement program. The interpretation of the district court and the government would essentially erase the word pursuant from the statute. In the government's view, the purpose of that language is, and I give an example of if a judgment debtor has $1,000 in disposable earnings and his employer contributes $200 on a periodic basis to the pension plan, then the 25% would be the $300. Now, we don't dispute that's a proper interpretation, but we say that the words pursuant to, by their very language, do not limit themselves simply to that. And then when the $200, if the $200 comes out as a pension payment later, a periodic pension payment later in the example I've given, then that is covered by the language of the Consumer Credit Protection Act, and the government is only entitled to 25% of that. The government takes a position, as the court held below, that the government is entitled to 100% of that pension payment. And we think this just ignores the language of the Consumer Credit Protection Act, the words pursuant to, which are straightforward, unambiguous. There really, in our view, can be no persuasive reading of that language.
Can you clarify something for me, please?
Sure.
The $38,000?
Yes.
Are you acknowledging that as being subject to taking?
No. We acknowledge that that is not subject to the 25% limitation. It's a one-time payment. I don't think that the term periodic payment could be extended to a one-time payment that can be obtained by Mr. Lee, and we would acknowledge that the government can get 100% of that one-time payment.
What's the total amount we're looking at as far as the dispute goes
here? Well, there are payments under, there are three plans here. One is a $2,000 annual payment. I think that's under the 401k plan. Under the defined benefit plan, it's a $3,000 annual payment, and then there's a deferred compensation non-qualified plan, which is to be paid over 60 payments over some period of time. So depending on how long Mr. Lee lives and how long he takes payments from the pension plan, it's not a huge amount of money from his standpoint, obviously, but it's an important amount, and as it would be for anybody who is on a fixed income and is retired. Mr. Lee is, I believe, in his early 70s. His work life is probably not too many more years. So, I see a few minutes left. I will save the remainder of my time for my rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilman. Mr. Pelletieri.
May it please the Court, John Pelletieri on behalf of the United States. Regarding the issue of timeliness, the relevant focus is on the substance and context of the proceeding below. Here, the substance of the proceeding below was enforcement of a sentence in a criminal case, in particular, the enforcement of a restitution order that was entered at sentencing at the defendant's sentence. So under the standard that applies to determine whether a case is civil or criminal for purposes of Rule 4, this would appear to be a criminal case. Mr. Lee refers to the Perry case. That case is distinguishable in at least two respects. The issue there was, in many ways, basically collateral to the issue of enforcement of the restitution award. It was a dispute between two victims of the fraud in that case about priority in a lien. And in addition, it was an appeal by an intervener, a third-party intervener, and Rule 4 states that a defendant in a criminal case must file a notice of appeal within 14 days. So the rule wasn't applicable to a third-party intervener. Turning to the merits.
May I ask a question regarding restitution here? Isn't the restitution collateral to the actual punishment and therefore in the nature of a civil pursuit?
The provisions that allow, and indeed in this case and in many cases require, a district court to impose restitution are under the federal criminal sentencing statutes at 18.
Mandatory Victim Restitution Act, Title 18, Section 3013.
But 3552 is where the authority derives to enter restitution, and the Mandatory Victims Restitution Act requires concern. Yeah. So if you look to 18, I think 3552, and it's cited in the brief, the specific provisions of Title 18 in the sentencing provisions of 3550, I don't know the specific provision, but that's where the district court's authority to impose restitution as a component of a criminal sentence derives, and then the mandatory aspect derives from the MVRA. Turning to the merits, the Consumer Credit Protection Act protects garnishment of compensation that an employer pays to an employee in exchange for personal services. Whether that compensation is paid to the employee who can take it home as take-home pay, or whether the compensation is paid into a retirement fund, such as a 401k. So, for example, if I were to receive $1,000 a week from my employer, $800 in a paycheck that I can take home and do what I want with, and then $200 of which is put into a retirement plan, like a 401k, a creditor could obtain an order of garnishment order that requires my employer to turn over $250 per week, $200 of the $800, 25%, and $50 of the $200, 25%. Once any money is paid into a retirement fund, it's no longer earnings for purposes of the CCPA. At that point, it's an asset. It's not. The CCPA doesn't speak to whether a creditor can access that asset to satisfy a debt. It's like being put into a bank account, which, as for example, several courts, but in particular the Ninth Circuit, Justice Judge Kennedy, his opinion made clear that once wages are put into a bank account, they are no longer earnings for purposes of the Consumer Credit Protection Act. And the Kokoska decision by the Supreme Court held that in that case, the individual there had claimed too many exemptions, and so then on a weekly or monthly basis, an excess amount of his paycheck was withheld and provided to the IRS, which is in many ways similar to a portion being put in a retirement fund. And at the end of the year, he got a refund from the IRS, and the IRS gave him the amount that he had overpaid that had been accumulating during each pay period that he should have gotten in a paycheck. And the Supreme Court held that did not qualify as earnings under the Consumer Credit Protection Act. So again, once compensation goes into a bank account or a retirement fund, it's no longer earnings. The Credit Consumer Protection Act doesn't speak to a creditor's ability to access that. Other statutes do speak to that. ERISA says that those assets are inalienable. Other statutes speak to various other types of retirement plans, whether it's a veterans retirement plan or other types of plans. They're generally inalienable, and a creditor cannot access them. What makes this case distinct is that it's a restitution case. It's a proceeding under the MVRA, which has in the MVRA, Congress has overridden the anti-alienation provisions of ERISA and things of that sort. So basically the United States government can access a retirement fund or a pension fund, whereas in a general debt collection action, a creditor cannot access it. So that's why we're in this unique situation here. Unless the court has any additional questions, the government rests on its brief.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Smith.
Thank you. Just very briefly, these arguments that the government is making are the same arguments that were made in the Decay case before the Fifth Circuit. That the only court of appeals to rule on this issue, and that found that the 25% limitation does apply to periodic pension payments. There's no question that these are payments that would be made to Mr. Lee, the annual payments that would be made to him, or perhaps the 60 payments that would be made under the deferred compensation are periodic payments that are pursuant to a pension plan. Though that is the language of the Consumer Credit Protection Act, The government's argument attempts to tie this into, says, well, it must be directly related to work. Well, that is not the language of the statute, and we argue for a plain reading of the statute, one that does not eliminate any of the words of the statute, and we would ask that this court reverse the order of the district court and remand this case for further proceedings.
Thank you. Again, thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.